This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Greetings, Bill Mobley for the Sanford Institute for Empathy and Compassion, and together with my co-host, Nyla Chowdhury, who is a director of social impact and innovation at the UC Extension, UCSD Extension, we're pleased to have another guest appearing now with us on Compassion Beyond Borders. During this series, we talked to really interesting people who have done amazing things, things that have helped humanity in very, very many ways, and people who have met challenges in their lives and have responded in ways that are very, very appropriate and helpful, and in fact, have not only helped themselves, but others. So Nyla, will you introduce our guest, please?
Thank you, Dr. Mobley. Today's guest is an inspirational visionary leader, Carrie Hessler Radelet. She's the president and CEO of Project Concern International and president of Global Communities. They serve millions of people in 35 countries. She was the director of Peace Corps under President Obama. Her leadership in global development to enhance health, end hunger, human trafficking projects, sexual abuse, women empowerment, all have been remarkable. She has shown that empathy, compassion, and resilience is the most important leadership skill needed today. She has been an outstanding mentor to many like me. It is my pleasure to welcome you, Carrie. Thank you for being with us.
So nice to be with you, my dear friend.
Would you kindly share with us your life's journeys and challenges?
Sure. Thank you. And I just want to say what a privilege it is to be with you. I grew up in the Midwest, Wisconsin and Michigan. Some people come from military families. I come from a Peace Corps family. We are the first and only four-generation Peace Corps family. My aunt was a volunteer in Turkey in the very early days of Peace Corps in the 1960s. My grandparents served as volunteers in Malaysia in the early 70s. My husband, Steve, and I served as Peace Corps volunteers in Samoa in the early 1980s, and my cousin served in Thailand at that same time. And then my nephew served in Mozambique from 2005 to 2007. So when I was a child, the only thing I ever wanted to be was a Peace Corps volunteer. And so I was thrilled when my husband and I were assigned to serve as Peace Corps volunteers in Western Samoa, a tiny little island in the South Pacific. We taught at an all-girls Catholic school called Pope Paul VI College, and we loved it. We loved the girls. We just loved our experience. We loved being part of the Samoan community. And I have to say that it was there that I first learned the critical importance of girls' education and empowerment, something that I have really valued my whole life. What I did not anticipate, however, was that I would be sexually assaulted as a Peace Corps volunteer. My assailant, the person who sexually assaulted me, was my associate Peace Corps director and my direct supervisor. He was a very high-ranking Samoan. He assaulted me three times over a period of 18 months, and each assault took place in the Peace Corps office. He stalked me when I went to the office alone without my husband. It was a really big office, and he would watch me at every moment. He followed me into the library or the photocopy room, which had doors, or waited until most people had left the office at the end of the day. You know, I tried so hard to avoid him, but I had to go into the office. It's where we picked up our mail, where we got our monthly living allowance. It's where we got our medical care, and we had meetings with staff people there. I'll spare you the details, but for me, Peace Corps and the Peace Corps office was not a safe place. Each time it happened, and it happened three times over a period of 18 months, I felt numb. I was embarrassed. I was enraged. I felt completely humiliated, and I blamed myself. I really was afraid that no one would believe me, and I was scared that Steve and I would be forced to leave Samoa and the work that we love so much. And more than anything, I did not want my assailant to steal my Peace Corps experience. I had wanted to be a Peace Corps volunteer all my life, and I desperately wanted to be seen as a good volunteer, and that did not include being a victim. And also, I would say that Peace Corps, like most places in the 1980s, most workplaces, had absolutely no provision for reporting or addressing rape or sexual assault. So there seemed no point in disclosing what had happened to me. The only person I told during that time was my husband, Steve, who I swore to silence. And I have to be honest to say that the long-term pain and rage and sense of hopelessness that he experienced was maybe even greater than mine. And I think that is something that people need to understand. Anyway, I buried my violations as deeply as I could, and I stayed silent about my assault until 30 years later when, as you heard from Nyla, I eventually became the Peace Corps director. And it was then that I encountered for the first time a group of volunteers who shared their own personal, deeply painful and incredibly courageous stories of their own sexual assault while they served as Peace Corps volunteers. And they shared their deep grief and their concern and their disappointment with the way that Peace Corps had handled their situations over the years. And as I listened to their stories, I felt like I was listening to my own story. And I realized then that I had failed them, that we had failed them. In failing them, we had contributed to their pain and made it difficult for them to recover. And their stories were, for me, like a clarion call for the need for change. So as a survivor, hearing their stories forced me to confront my own sexual assault, because for nearly 30 years, I had buried my own story really deep within me and told nobody apart from Steve. So I knew that if I was going to lead the agency in this time of crisis, I had to own my past. I need to go public with what had happened to me, and I had to speak truth. And I had, mind you, never told my parents, never told my children, never told my friends and former volunteers, never told my Peace Corps Samoa family. So I had to go public about all of that. That was the beginning of my own journey to healing and acceptance. And it was also the beginning of a long journey to create Peace Corps Sexual Assault Risk Reduction and Response Program. I want to say that what happened to me is quite unusual. It's not common at all for volunteers to be assaulted by Peace Corps staff, but it has happened, and Peace Corps does not tolerate it. Peace Corps has come a long, long way since that time and is really now considered a leader in the area of sexual assault risk reduction and response. It has also shared its experiences, tools, and trainings with other government agencies and universities and partner nations and international nonprofits. Through my own experience, and especially the experience of the volunteers who shared their story with me, and by mobilizing our entire agency, Peace Corps was able to make more than 30 policy changes. They trained every single volunteer and every staff people. They continue to do that. We created an Office of Victim Advocacy. We developed specialized training and trauma-informed care for first responders. We supported a hotline for people that was hosted by an external organization. So if they didn't trust the staff, they'd have an independent party to go to. And we were also able to convene a sexual assault advisory council, which was composed of our nation's leading experts in this area. But the most important thing that happened at Peace Corps is that Peace Corps now does not shy away from the truth of volunteers' stories. Rather, these stories have become the catalyst for the most extensive reform effort the agency has undertaken. It was a reform that is dedicated to placing volunteer care and support at the forefront of everything it does. So like the Me Too movement, Peace Corps' journey towards reconciliation began when a small group of volunteers came forward to tell their stories and to bring healing to their lives and say that this must stop. So that has become, ironically, my life's journey as well. Now I'm in the nonprofit space. I lead two international nonprofit organizations. And we find that in the international development and humanitarian assistance space, sexual assault, harassment, abuse, and exploitation is taking place all the time as well. It's a sector dedicated to helping the most vulnerable, and yet sexual assault, abuse, and exploitation is very common. And what we know is that sexual assault robs one's dignity, and it debilitates the survivor, and it robs us all of humanity. And so now, standing up loud and publicly against sexual assault and harassment of all kinds has become my life's work. And I never expected that, but that is where life has taken me.
It's a very powerful story. And the journey begins with something unexpected and quite negative and quite painful. Can't imagine what you must have gone through. And then it moves to a stage where, well, I have no way to speak about this. I have no way to inform anybody. Maybe I won't even be believed. And then finally, with time and wisdom, a chance to really not just make a difference that sort of seemed to be reactive, but really pro-social and proactive in a way that takes some bitterness and anger and turns it into something very, very compassionate, so that the empathy you could feel now with your colleagues could now be turned into an act of compassion to prevent this kind of abuse going forward. So what a great story. And you know, it's dealing with challenges like that that are so very important for us to understand.
You know, it's so true. And honestly, I really know that if those women, and there were also men who came forward too, but initially they were women, if they had not had the courage to speak truth to me, and it's not that easy when you're a Peace Corps volunteer to call out your own individual pain to the director of a federal agency, but they did. They had the courage to do that. And if it were not for their courage, I wonder if it ever would have happened. I really do. So it's so important to speak up about your own experience. I'm so eternally grateful to those truth tellers.
It's a great lesson for us, Carrie. And yeah. We thank you for that lesson. And we recognize that pain still sits there. And it's not easy to resolve that issue, but your life is a model for having the courage to move forward to help and protect others. So thank you for that. Nyla, I wonder if you have another question for Carrie.
Yeah, well, she's been a source of change for me and many women altogether, I would say. Yes, I would. She's had a huge merger in her nonprofits, and it would be lovely to see with the new norms how she's planning the challenge and going forward and the impact through COVID-19.
Well, thank you for that. I want to point out to everyone that I'm wearing my button that says, I am the source of change, and Nyla is the one who gave me this. And I draw a great deal of support and just emotional and spiritual nurture from Nyla, who's my dear friend. So I run now two organizations. I share leadership of global communities, and then I'm still president and CEO of PCI, which is a global communities partner. We're a subsidiary organization. I'm also the chair of Interaction, which you may or may not have heard of. It's an umbrella organization of about 200 international nonprofits in the international development and humanitarian assistance space. So the large organizations that you're very familiar with, World Vision and CARE and Save the Children. And then, you know, organizations like mine, PCI and Global Communities and others. And so my focus has really become in really helping nonprofits become organizations with cultures that uphold the dignity and common humanity of each staff person and each stakeholder. And also to provide a safe environment for those who have been harmed in any way to come forward for services and support. So my organization, PCI, began this journey about a year ago. Our initial focus is on placing sexual assault risk reduction and response within the larger context of amplifying civility and kindness and compassion and gender equality and diversity and inclusion into all we do in our workplace and the work that we do on the ground, and also the way we treat each other. So our goal is really to infuse our work at all level with a greater commitment to uplifting dignity of each human being and celebrating the differences that make our world so incredibly beautiful and diverse. We really want to elevate compassion for all people. It's what we do in our work lives. It's the work that we do on the ground as we enhance health and end hunger and advance women and girls. But in order to do that, we feel that we need to eliminate, if we possibly can, all of the social norms that make it acceptable in any way to violate another human being. So my experience is that unless organizations like ours address the underlying culture that makes demeaning anybody acceptable, we as a global community will not be able to bring about real and lasting change. And that is the hard work that requires daily commitment from all of us. So now we're all, you know, living at home, working from home. I'm at home now. You're all at home. You know, we're in the middle of this COVID-19 outbreak in the United States, which has highlighted not only here in our country, but globally, the existing economic disparities that are present, have always been present. And in this country in particular, I think people were shocked at the fragility of the social safety net. And it's really leaving vulnerable communities to bear the brunt of the crisis. So while the virus infects rich people and poor people, so people regardless of who they are, the poor are more severely affected due to their limited economic resources, their reliance on jobs in the service and retail industry, and the high cost of medical care. So many people living in poverty around the world, but in San Diego as well, have no savings to weather unemployment and stock up on, you know, they can't even stock up on food supplies. It's a huge challenge. You know, food security is suddenly a big question in San Diego, one of our country's shining cities. And as is common across the globe, in times of economic crisis, these vulnerabilities are more pronounced by those or for those who are marginalized because of their gender, their race, their immigration status, and a number of other, reasons. So the thing that I've been thinking about in terms of this issue, sort of connecting the dots between my work around addressing sexual exploitation and abuse, the work that we've been doing in building up communities, organizations, and communities that really honor the dignity and common humanity of all people, and COVID-19 is to address the issue in particular of the special vulnerabilities of those who have to stay at home because of the stay-at-home order and other restrictions on movement. But because of the fact that they are in close proximity with other people, they may be, in fact, in a very dangerous setting, both because they have greater exposure to the virus, but also because they're exposed to people who practice domestic violence, human trafficking. They might be people who abuse alcohol or drugs. And so the United Nations has called for urgent action to put women's safety first and at the top of the list in terms of combating a worldwide surge in domestic violence that is really directly attributable to COVID-19 as one of those unspoken unexpected, really, consequences of COVID-19. And so one of the things we're doing in San Diego, PCI is working, and Nyla is very familiar with this work. We work with other localizations, including UCSD, to combat child sex trafficking through the San Diego Trafficking Prevention Collective. So we're working closely with the DA's office and UBS Bank, local foundations, UCSD, but other university partners as well, local businesses, other nonprofit partners, both local and larger, to try to protect students from exploitation. And so our program is a comprehensive program, and we work hand in hand with school districts to ensure that they have the right prevention measures and agile programming to be able to respond to the unique needs of kids, especially a very diverse student body, which is what San Diego has. Our program includes programs to address early childhood education, participatory theater. We really connect with lived experience expert voices and others who can bring their own personal voice into the story. And then we have age-appropriate curricula. So now suddenly we have COVID-19 and our school-based program, which was really just getting going, is suddenly, you know, has to be done differently because we're all working from home now, and the students are working from home and the teachers are teaching from home. So we've had to adapt our program and we've had to take it online. And so one of the programs that we do is something called Project Roots, which is a program for kids from age 8 to 13 to teach them leadership skills and teach them, resilience and help them understand the tactics used by traffickers as appropriate. But really, it's about building resilient adolescents. And so we have adapted that program to a COVID-19 survival kit. And it works with the students, but also with their parents and with their teachers. And they're able to implement it at home and via distance learning. And so we really want to help kids feel safe at home, especially because of the increased anxiety and the vulnerability that kids are already feeling because of COVID-19. And especially if they're in a home where there's an abusive parent, it's just really important that they get the support they need. So this kit includes short, easy to use lessons on emotional well-being. There's an online and a social media safety kind of module, because a lot of the human trafficking is transacted actually on cell phones and other social media, other digital approaches are very commonly used to promote human trafficking. And we also want to be teaching parents to practice empathy during this time of need. It's really hard to be a kid and be stuck at home. So those are some of the things that we're doing right there in San Diego to kind of connect the dots.
Carrie, your story is amazing, and you continue to build on what a terrific career you had. We thank you for your work. Since we're the Institute for Empathy and Compassion, we get what you're doing and are really proud of you. And so let's stay in touch and keep up the great work. And again, Carrie, thank you for being on the
program. Thank you so much. It was really just a privilege to be with you.
Thanks so much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.